106.
I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Shell shock was the term used to describe the psychological traumas that soldiers experienced on the battlefields of World War I. Decades later, the diagnosis was post-traumatic stress disorder for veterans of the Vietnam War. More has been learned about the impact of war since then, and today a number of soldiers and Marines who served in Iraq and Afghanistan are being treated for PTSD. Today on Radio Times, we want to talk about something that does not have a diagnosis. It's called moral injury. It's the price a soldier can pay when what they have done and seen in combat violates their most basic beliefs and values. Our guest David Wood wrote about it in a three-part series in the Huffington Post, where he's senior military correspondent. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for his series on the wounded veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And David Wood joins us from the NPR studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
And also with us and joining us, in fact, here in our Philadelphia studios is Peter Yeomans. He's a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. And Peter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Privileged to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And I should say that Peter Yeomans is someone that David Wood interviewed for this three-part series that he had in the Huffington Post. David, if I can begin with you and even begin where your series begins, a Marine named Nick Rudolph is in a firefight in Afghanistan. He kills a young boy. Can you describe what he described to you?
Sure. So there was a really, really bad firefight one day in Afghanistan several years ago. Nick Rudolph, a young Marine, 22 years old. At one point, he saw a figure coming around the corner of an adobe building. The person was shooting at him with an AK-47. And Nick got him in his sights with his M4 carbine. And just before he pulled the trigger, he realized that's a 13-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And he pulled the trigger and killed him dead. So in that particular instance, that was the perfectly moral thing to do because he was protecting himself and his fellow Marines. But in any other place, that's, killing a kid mm-hmm. is not good. So Nick came home now out of the Marine Corps, still struggling with what he did.
He says to you, you know it's wrong, talking about what he did, but you have no choice. He says that twice. You know it's wrong, but you have no choice. His struggle with his decision.
Marty, here's the thing about moral injury that I've found through many years of battlefield reporting and then talking to experts like Peter Yeomans. There are two universes we're talking about here. One is the moral universe of wartime, in which there are specific rules and expectations and honor codes. And then there's the parallel but separate universe of our civilian society. And many things happen in combat which are good and moral according to the rules of that universe. The problem is that eventually warriors come home and try to reintegrate back into civilian society, and that's where the problem comes.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Peter Yeomans, because it sounds like one could think of this, and we're not talking about a diagnosis here, and I think that's very important to establish for our listeners, but it sounds like a form of PTSD where something happens or someone does something, and they're in deep anxiety about what they have done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly there's a lot of overlap between the constructs of PTSD and moral injury, but there's some important differences as well. PTSD has really been classified as an anxiety disorder, so with an emphasis on chronic anxiety, sense of life threat and such, and the experiences that would generate that in an individual. It's also considered a psychiatric disorder, whereas moral injury is bringing a different emphasis. It's really trying to acknowledge and, in a sense, also honor, I think, the effects of having to make very fast and sometimes definitive decisions, or to witness other people doing that in ambiguous situations, and the kind of anguish that can lead to upon eventual reflection. It's not trying to suggest that reaction is somehow disordered, is a psychiatric problem, but is more really trying to acknowledge how painfully difficult that can be in any human, any sensitive human being.
If anxiety is associated with PTSD, is it regret? Is that what we're talking about when we talk about something like moral injury, Peter?
A regret would certainly be a component of it. I think people who are really doing the research are still trying to understand, what the hallmark symptoms or reactions of it are, but certainly could include guilt, shame, regret, sort of a strong tendency towards negative attribution of self, so really powerfully self-denigrating thoughts about self.
Blaming self.
Blaming oneself, thinking that that I'm a bad person. Right.
Going back to you, David, even going back to Nick Rudolph, he comes back to the States, and how does he struggle with what he has done in this firefight?
Well, Marty, Nick and people like him who've had similar kinds of experiences seem to me to bounce back between two frames of mind. One is that I did what I had to do, and that's okay, and they just become numb. I don't want to think about it. And then the other extreme is I did something horrible. I'm a bad person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a really hard thing to struggle with. And again, you know, Nick Rudolph is a great young man. He's gainfully employed. He's a wonderful person to hang around with, and he's not disabled in any sense. But this is something he does struggle with.
Do you think there's something new about this, David Wood? I mean, you know, we have been in wars, I guess, since human beings have been able to, you know, pick up a rock and throw it at somebody. Do you think there's something new about this idea of moral injury?
Well, yes and no. Homer wrote about this 20 centuries ago.
Well, exactly. That's what I was thinking of. Yes, no, go ahead.
I'm sure you were thinking of that. And and warriors throughout time have struggled with what you referred to, shell shock. We've called it various names. Now we call that particular thing post-traumatic stress disorder. I think moral injury has been particularly acute for the 1.9 million Americans who served in Iraq or Afghanistan for this reason. Back in 1973, this country decided we didn't want to have a draft for the military. We wanted to hire a professional army, and we did. Professional armies cost a lot of money, and that means that it's a relatively small military force, about 1.4 million active duty folks. That means that when you're involved in two wars, people have to go over and over and over again. And people did over the last 12 years. And I think that imposed a different kind of stress, physical and mental, than veterans of past wars are dealing with.
I'd be curious, Peter, how you think about that.
Yeah, I would agree with David's remark to first acknowledge that the moral questions in war are as old as war itself. And I would also highlight some of his rationale for why maybe it's more prevalent or certainly warrants additional consideration today. I would also include the Vietnam veterans as well. And part of why I'm thinking about that is because there is some very fascinating evidence to suggest that that our military used to be much less lethal than it is now, and that between the Second World War and the Vietnam War, the military realized how relatively ineffective at firing their weapons or overcoming the inhibition of firing your weapons was in their World War II ranks. And they really modified their training significantly and significantly have decreased the what you might call the non-firing rate of the troops. So it seems to me, based on that, we would assume that that a greater proportion of our veterans are struggling with most uncertain acts of possible moral injury, moral transgression in this case.
And let me make what you're saying is important. I want to make mm-hmm. sure everyone understands that you're saying that in our more current wars, literally soldiers and Marines on the battlefield fire more bullets than in previous wars like World War II or World War I even.
That's right. In World War II, military historians concluded that the non-firing rate might have been as high as 80%. And that's based on interviews, based on muskets found on the Gettysburg battlefield that were loaded multiple times. People hadn't been firing their weapons at the rate that they were supposed to be doing. And they addressed that, and they estimate by Vietnam the non-firing rate really was about 5%. Presumably that's continued. So the military has successfully, and in a sense out of necessity, has figured out how to help soldiers overcome some of those initial inhibitions to engage in taking life.
Does that make sense to you, David?
It does. I was just thinking of a survey of combat Marines back in 2004 that I turned up in my reporting. It found that 65% of the Marines had killed an enemy combatant. That's a really high rate of killing. Mm. And that 28% felt somehow responsible for the death of a civilian, maybe not directly as in Nick Rudolph's case, but in some sense. So I think one of the things we've found in the wars of the last decade has been that even though there are a lot of people who go to the war zone and who are not directly involved in killing, those who are involved in direct combat see a lot of it, and it's pretty intense.
Well, and what I hear from you, David, is that in many ways we have soldiers, Marines, who are in a sense isolated or separated from most of the rest of the population. It's the 1% that's not the rich 1%. Then you've got these multiple tours, and then as you and Peter are talking about, a high rate of firing one's weapon. Do you think those three things have sort of led to this moral injury? To you, David?
Well, imagine Nick Rudolph coming home now, having been in combat two tours, pretty bad stuff. In one of those tours, as I said, he killed a 13-year-old boy. He thought he was 13. He may have been 10 or 15. Mm. But he felt he killed a child. When he comes home, who can he talk to about that? People would come up to him at the airport and say, thank you for your service. And he'd think, well, you don't know what I did. You can't possibly know. You know, it reminds me, going to war, I was thinking about this morning. You can't know what it's like until you get there. It's like people who have never seen the ocean and then see it on TV or in the movies and imagine it. And then they go see it and they're like, whoa, this is totally different than what I expected. And that's kind of what war is. It's such an intense, incandescent experience where terror and boredom are mixed. And there's a lot of really good stuff that happens to people who deploy to war, the camaraderie, the sense of purpose and achievement, sense of responsibility. A lot of people come home feeling very proud of what they did. But it's such a searing experience that I think many of them find they can't talk to any civilians about it.
And we're almost up in a break here. One of the things that you write, David, in your piece, I think quoting one of the Marines you talked to, once you know the truth of war, you can't unknow it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It stays with you forever. And again, many of these experiences are things that are so painful to think about or touch upon. I'm talking about your own experiences that many veterans don't talk about them at all. And I know so many families of veterans who say, grandpa or dad never talked about the war. He would not talk about it. And it's a shame. Well, people keep it bottled up.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's David Wood. He's a senior military correspondent for the Huffington Post and just did a three-part series on something we're talking about. It's not an actual psychological diagnosis, but it's called moral injury. Also with us, Peter Yeomans. He's a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We especially want to hear from the veterans in our audience. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove supports WHYY. From April 12th through the 27th, the museum and the center's annual juried art show will be open to the public. In addition to original works inspired by nature, this year's show features a flock of hundreds of origami passenger pigeons commemorating the centennial of the species extinction. Visitors can hike more than 5 miles of historic trails in the footsteps of America's best-known bird artist. For more information, online, johnjames.audubon.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a new film tells the story of Eric Lomax, a British soldier tortured by the Japanese during World War II.
My husband isn't coping.
War leaves a mark, Mrs. Lomax.
We'll meet the real-life Mrs. Lomax next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under Gianandrea Nuzzada, performs Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the power of the Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ's 6,938 pipes.
Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Peter Yeomans and David Wood about something called moral injury. And it's how soldiers, Marines struggle with things they maybe did or didn't do in combat that has challenged, it's undermined their values, their ethical beliefs. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We've been talking about how difficult it is for a veteran to talk about some of these difficult issues. But Peter, I mean, as a clinical psychologist, your job is to help people talk about it and understand what they have done and maybe even to forgive themselves. I'm thinking about people that might want to talk to a family member who has served. Do you have advice about that?
Advice specifically about talking to a family member, or more generally how to begin to...
Well, maybe more generally makes more sense.
Okay. I would first connect back to something David said earlier, which was to remark on how various people's journeys are and the different schedules people are on in a sense for beginning to make this choice about to come to terms with what happens. And it can vary from someone coming to my office for the first time and saying, I need to talk about what happened. They might even say, I need to try to clear my conscience. And then at the other end, you have people who will say, things happened that I will never tell anyone. And I will choose to always try not to think about. But overall, as a clinician, the goal is to try to support someone in however they want to cope with that history. And if that's to not talk about it, then certainly we would respect that. I think there's a general sense that long-term people are helped by trying to come to terms with these things. So you're trying to create a safe and structured place and opportunity for someone to do just that. And also to acknowledge that one option is to work with a clinician, another is to work with a family member, or a combination sometimes, bring family into the office. And there are other places, too, in terms of pastoral support, right? So people, you want to connect people to their who they trust the most, in a sense, and try to help them find ways to begin to put words to their experience.
And just based on what we've been talking about, and just even using the there are several people that are in David Wood's report, but we've been talking about this one, Nick, and is the goal for dealing with this moral injury to figure out how to forgive oneself? Because you did something you regretted, but because you were in war, you felt like you had to do it.
I think that's part of the goal. There's probably more to it than just forgiveness. I think that, if you think about how deep and profound the values of service are around loyalty and commitment and effort and morality, in a sense, mm-hmm. and yet people are making these very difficult decisions so quickly, and they have to then draw these quick conclusions about, well, that wasn't supposed to happen. Right, all my training and everything was against that, and then this thing happened, and so they're trying to understand how it happened. The quickest conclusion to make is that it was my fault. I'm a bad person, right? If you just take a glimpse at the event, and that's pretty much people are in some ways just glimpsing at it and trying to push it away, that's the quickest way to try to find an answer to how that could happen.
Yeah.
But obviously that's lacking critical context for why that happened. Right, so that's a larger goal of therapy, or more generally people trying to tell the story and talk about it, is to be connected to a fuller memory of what happened, what was the situation, why did it happen, what other choices did I have, does this happen to other people? And from there you can begin to make appropriate meaning for it so that you can carry it the rest of your life, because you will carry it the rest of your life, and possibly even to use it to deepen your own life and figure out how it brings meaning to your life so you can go forward.
David, let me go back to you, and even to go back to your series, you also interviewed a Marine named Martz. Again, he was in Afghanistan. There was a young boy who would be hanging around with the Marines, and it sounds like they kind of befriended this young boy. And then he detonated a bomb. And Martz says, I let my men down. I think every one of those Marines was wounded in some kind of way. And he's left to struggle with his inability, obviously a little boy there, but also his inability to protect his men.
Yeah, Sergeant March told me that before they left Camp Lejeune, I think it was on his third deployment, family and friends of the guys he was deploying with gathered around, and they all said to him, you know, bring my boy home safe. You know, don't let anything happen. And he was thinking, how can I possibly prevent that? And they'd go out on patrol, and he'd think, you know, I have to know where the IEDs are. I have to know where the threats are. I have to be able to warn my men, and you can't possibly do that. And so when this IED went off, and it wounded every single one of his Marines, including Sergeant Martz, he just felt so guilty and ashamed that he had not been able to protect his men. An unrealistic expectation, to be sure. But the pain he felt several years later is still very, very acute. But it brings up something I wanted to add on to what Peter was so ably explaining, and that is the business of providing context for something like that. Some of the best therapy I've come across consists of asking someone like Sergeant Martz, okay, so you were in charge of this platoon, and it got attacked, and men were hurt, and that's partly your fault. There's no way to get around that. You didn't warn your men. But let's look at who else played in that scenario. So the Taliban, you know, let's assign everybody and every factor a percent, and it can only add up to 100. So you didn't warn your men, you get 20%, maybe 30%, maybe 50%. The Taliban, the guys who built the bomb, you know, the Marine recruiter who got you into the Marine Corps plays a part. The young boy, certainly, who pulled the trigger. God, or luck. And add it all up, and it helps that person, like Sergeant March, begin to say, okay, you know, maybe I didn't warn my people, and maybe if I'd been smarter and more alert, I could have, but I don't have to carry this burden by myself. And so that person can now go forward into the future without feeling like I'm a totally bad person, I can't do anything right, I'm doomed, and I shouldn't even exist.
I think it's interesting that Martz wants to be a therapist.
Yeah, I found that a lot. You know, people get damaged in wartime. They come home. This applies to people who've been physically damaged, too. I've come across several people who were badly wounded, who went through a long recovery process and now are going into occupational or physical therapy. But Sergeant March is headed towards a career of helping other people struggle through the same things he's struggling with.
You know, David, because I know you've covered wars, you've spent time in wars, this is your beat in a sense. Is this idea of moral injury, is that a new idea to you? Is that something that you found on the battlefield, or you came home and began to think about?
Something I came across fairly recently, but then thinking back about my own experiences and people that I've known on the battlefield began to make more and more sense, and I just became totally convinced that it is moral injury, not PTSD, and not traumatic brain injury, that is the signature wound of the wars we've been through in the last 12 years. You know, I came across something interesting the other day. 152,000 active duty troops diagnosed with PTSD. That may sound like a lot, but again, that's out of 1.4 million people. Mm-hmm. So the actual number of people diagnosed with PTSD is relatively small. For sure, it's understated because a lot of people have it and haven't been diagnosed. It doesn't include veterans, and so it understates the general prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder. But that's a very, very narrow psychiatric diagnosis, as Peter has explained, and I think that the general war trauma extends far beyond it.
Mm. To what we're really talking about, where someone really sort of questions, what kind of person am I? As a result of what I may or may not have done in war?
Yeah, the other pretty clear example I came across was I know a number of medics who were unable to save a mortally wounded soldier or Marine, someone who was so badly wounded that if he had been wounded in the best emergency center in the world, they couldn't have saved him. But here's this medic on his hands and knees, desperately trying to save someone who's bleeding out, maybe bullets kicking up around him. Which happens very often because people get wounded in firefights, and the person he's working on dies. And the medic is thinking, just enormous guilt. And, you know, I should have been able to save him. And very often there are soldiers and Marines around him shouting, save him, save him, save him.
Right.
So when he can't, that's a pretty heavy thing. And many medics that I know struggled with questions like, what could I should have done this. I should have done this first and then that. I should have had this piece of equipment. If only I'd had another 6 months of training. And I'm a bad person. I let this person die. And that's pretty prevalent.
Yeah, and very powerful and certainly upsetting as well. And I do want to get to our callers, but let me just put one a question back to you, Peter Yeomans, which is, I mean, is it possible to compartmentalize these things that we've been talking about and to live a full and satisfied life? Or is there a price to pay for compartmentalization?
I couldn't offer any certainty about in my response to that question. I could only go back to the emphasis on how to respect how various people are in terms of what different people cope with, how they cope with it. I think it's fair to we'd have to assume that it's possible to deal with some of the situations David's describing and to compartmentalize them and live a quality life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot of examples of people doing that, and again, everyone seems to respond in different ways, and we need to respond to them as an individual that way.
And that's Peter Yeomans. He's a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Also with us, David Wood, senior military correspondent for the Huffington Post, and we're talking about a piece that David had in the Post recently, a three-part series on something called moral injury. I should add that he won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for his series on the wounded veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan War. Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Particularly interested in hearing from the veterans, the soldiers, the Marines in our audience. Let me get John from Trenton to join us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I think this is a great subject. I think this is the key to a lot of issues with military personnel coming back. I'm on a special operations team. I'm on an A team. I did two tours in Afghanistan. The last tour we had 42% of enemy contact was just on our team alone. Mm-hmm. Out of all the guys that were there, there was only three of us that weren't medevaced out at some point. So I've seen a lot of this. Just to add a couple of points that kind of you guys already went over, this is an important thing because we go to war with this Rambo mentality. We want to go in there and we want to save the world. I think for most of us, and I think for the good soldiers, we want to have a reason why we're put on this earth. We want to justify our existence. And when these bad things happen that don't work out to what we plan or what we think, it affects us. Like I said, the good soldier plays this in their head over and over again every day. The situation gets played in your head every day. And it hurts when people come up to you and say, oh, you serve, and we want to thank you for serving. And you say to yourself, but you don't know what I did, or the things that I did weren't so good. That's a big issue.
Well, John, first of all, I really appreciate you calling into the show, and you really touched on so many important things that we've been talking about, but you bring a reality to the conversation that I think is really quite moving and quite poignant. And only because, Peter, you and I were looking at each other, let me give you a chance to respond to John, and then I'll hear from you, David.
Sure. Yeah, just, again, appreciating John's remarks and how he's really highlighting how soldiers and Marines go to war with these really impeccable standards. They're imbued with incredible values, and they're trying to live up to them. And how could they know, as David said, it turns out to be an ocean they've never seen, the complexity of the situations that they're in, and then they have to wrestle with that.
And David, these rules of war, especially in wars as seemingly chaotic as the ones in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'd be curious what you say to John as well.
John raises a really interesting point, and that is that many, many people that I know have gone to Iraq or Afghanistan believing this was a hugely moral and noble enterprise, that we're going not just to kill people and win a military victory, but we're going to help build a new life for people. And it's been the experience of many, I think, that especially after two deployments or more, you know what, we're not really helping these people. In fact, they don't like us. In fact, they're trying to kill us. And you know, the very, very high aspirations people have going into this situation often are not realized. And so I think a lot of people come home with this vague, uneasy sense of, you know, that wasn't so good. Mm. You know, I had to tell my wife and kids, I'm going to go off to war, which is more important than being with you. So goodbye. But this is important. And then you go and it turns out not to be as noble as you thought. And I think that leads to, again, a vague sense of uneasiness, which we call moral injury.
In fact, going back to Nick Rudolph, David, in your piece, and he describes in Afghanistan, you know, helping, I guess Marines were helping to build a school, then the Taliban comes and they throw acid on the students, on the children's faces. And, you know, he just wonders, what was that all about? And then he sees this, it's an Afghan tradition, apparently, of young boys dancing for grown men, and then it looks like they go off together. And again, he witnesses this and wonders, what am I doing here? What am I fighting for?
Yeah, a lot of the young Marines that I know are pretty disgusted with Afghan culture and feel like what they did over there, risking their lives and seeing their buddies killed and wounded, just wasn't worth it.
Really? I mean, that's a pretty broad statement.
I'm just reflecting what they've told me.
I know, I hear you. I hear Peter, anything you want to add to that?
You know, what's coming up for me is also thinking about, you know, some of the pitfalls of this conversation about moral injury is to venture to suggest that people are making political judgments about whether a war was just or not, or somehow being moralistic, right? That's a critique people have had with this idea of moral injury, that somehow we're judging servicemen and women as being amoral, right? But really, what's really being highlighted here is the veteran's subjective sense of a moral struggle, in a sense, right? It's their experience. We're not suggesting that other people have done anything wrong at all.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but I think the civilian population, probably myself included, we talk about good wars and bad wars. But if you're there to fight it, it isn't black and white like that, Peter.
Right, and another thing that comes up commonly too is that our servicemen and women are their experience of it, their perspective of it isn't caught up in the politics when they're over there, right? They're not thinking about the larger issues. They're really actually very focused on keeping each other alive of the utmost.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers as well. And, John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And, again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about something called moral injury, and it's something that David Wood wrote about in a three-part series recently in the Huffington Post, where he's a senior military correspondent. Peter Yeomans is a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The John James Audubon Center at Mill Grove supports WHYY. From April 12th through the 27th, the museum and the center's annual juried art show will be open to the public. In addition to original works inspired by nature, this year's show features a flock of hundreds of origami passenger pigeons commemorating the centennial of the species extinction. Visitors can hike more than 5 miles of historic trails in the footsteps of America's best-known bird artist. For more information, online, johnjames.audubon.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a new film tells the story of Eric Lomax, a British soldier tortured by the Japanese during World War II.
My husband isn't coping.
War leaves a mark, Mrs. Lomax.
We'll meet the real-life Mrs. Lomax next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY.
the Philadelphia Orchestra, under Gianandrea Nuzzada, performed Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the power of the Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ's 6,938 pipes. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's get back to the phones. We have, looks like Maureen from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Maureen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. My comment was just that in my 20s, I did have a Vietnam vet drunkenly tell me about an incident like this, children running at him with automatic weapons, and they had to shoot. You know, I wanted so much for him to tell me that they got out of that without having to do that, and they didn't. And I've thought about that a lot. I'm in a 12-step program, and I was wondering if that kind of counseling has ever been tried at the VA, where people share their experience. In my program, the only people that understand me and that I can hear are the ones that have been through it. We're allowed to share what we want, and what we don't want to, we don't talk to. But we share hope with each other. We share experience, what works. And that's what helps us get through the day. Just wondering if that approach has been taken.
Yeah, thanks. Maureen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. That's to you, Peter. And it sounds like some form of group therapy or AA model.
Sure. I'd begin by just noting that what the VAs offer is somewhat various, and I can only speak a little bit from the experience I have here at the Philadelphia VA. And there actually is a group that I don't know the specifics of it, but there is a group, a PTSD support group that's drawing on the 12-step model. I couldn't describe it more specifically than that, but just to say there are people thinking about how to integrate those two seemingly disparate topics. But more generally, group therapy, absolutely, I appreciate the caller naming that, and there are a variety of different types of groups. They all are supportive. Some of them are more skills-focused, some are more supportive, but if it does seem essential that to find a shared sense of understanding has to come from being with other veterans, and it's one of the limitations in a sense of individual therapy, though that also has advantages of its own. A lot of the more intensive group work where really people are sharing their stories is done in residential programs, for instance, out at the Coatesville VA, where a combat veteran can stay for, I think, 6, sometimes 8 weeks and really be part of a cohort of his peers, her peers, doing that kind of work. It's sometimes a little more complicated to do on an outpatient basis, but there are also examples of that, too.
David, I'm curious about how the Department of Defense looks at this or doesn't look at this issue of moral injury.
Marty, they don't like to look at it because it calls into question pretty much everything that they do. But I think spurred on by the rising rate of suicide, the military has really come in recent years, I think, to put a full court press on the whole issue of mental health problems among its personnel. I think they do a pretty good job now. But military mental health seems to me to be aimed at keeping people in the fight. So I've been with a Marine battalion in Afghanistan that had a psychologist assigned to it. And her job was exactly that. People who were having mental health issues could go see her, and she'd, in essence, patch them up and get them back into the fight. There's nothing wrong with that. It has to be done, but it's very limited. And I think much of the work that the Defense Department has done relating to moral injury and PTSD and other forms of war trauma is short-term and limited to what they call resiliency. In other words, trying to harden people to withstand the moral challenges that they meet on the battlefield.
And Peter, just quickly, if you don't mind, because I do want to get back to our callers, and I'm assuming that once someone returns from the battle or returns from war, then all the skills that you need to have when you're in war aren't necessary or begin to kind of fade away, and perhaps that's when the feelings that you might have put into a box begin to emerge.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, some of the specific skills become surprisingly difficult to translate into gainful employment. and some of the values which were held so deeply and people so clearly want to continue to express in their lives and be true to, in a sense. I hear countless stories of vets saying how alone they feel in trying to hold up those values in the civilian life, and we'll talk about how superficial, how petty civilian life seems to them, and therefore how acutely alone they feel that way.
And it's important to think about, you mentioned this to me during the break, about understanding, I guess, the loneliness that, that a returning soldier or Marine can feel.
How different it would feel to come home from war and return to a society that somehow knew about the complexity of warfare and the anguish that might come with that. And to return to that would be a real acknowledgement, basically, and normalization of what people are struggling with.
And
that's not the case, obviously, in our culture today.
And David, is that why some of the Marines that you talked to, they really bristled when people would say to them, thank you for your service?
I think it's hard for them to understand how civilians look at this. Most civilians don't know what war is like or what people really do there. I know a platoon sergeant, for example, who took his guys to Iraq and brought them all home safe. An enormous accomplishment and a very, very skilled person to be able to do that. But you can't explain to someone who's never been in a platoon or been to war how you did that and how highly skilled that person is. The other thing is that in combat, people pledge their lives to each other and act on that pledge on a daily basis or hourly basis. You can't get closer to another human being than you do in a unit in combat. When you come home and get out of the Marine Corps or the Army, you lose that. And there's nothing that can take its place, nothing.
Let me get Natalie from Fishtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Natalie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So for the past year, I've been dating, but I'm no longer dating, a former Army medic. He went to Iraq twice, and he is someone who can compartmentalize pretty well. He lives a daily life that looks pretty normal, but underneath he has a lot of anxiety and PTSD. He's been diagnosed. This conversation is hard for me to listen to because of how much it rings true for this person I dated. He at times has expressed that he feels like a murderer, and he doesn't think that anyone can understand what he's had to do and deal with. And this conversation is very on point about those things, but I'm wondering if your guest might be able to touch on what it might look like realistically to have someone be in the position of the person I recently dated and what moving forward really is.
Well, Natalie, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And actually, I want to put that to you, David Wood, because you write about a medic in your story. And Natalie says this guy that she dated was a medic, but he felt like a murderer.
Natalie, thank you for your call. Yeah. And, I hope someone can reach out to this person you're describing. And Peter can discuss what kind of therapies would be appropriate for someone like this. But let me just say that medics in particular who are in charge of saving lives carry an enormous burden. And the medics that I know have superb training. They are really, really good trauma specialists. I don't think that they get any particular training in how to absorb the experiences they get. And I hope that at some point the military realizes, when we send these people out to the battlefield to do these very, very difficult jobs, we have to teach them ways to absorb what they're experiencing and to deal with it and to take care of them when they come back, because I don't think we do a very good job.
Peter, what do you say to Natalie?
In terms of therapies that are available, again, the VA is just one of a few possible settings where someone could begin to take those steps. At the VA, there are a few specific individual therapies. We touched on groups already. The individual therapies are both trying to create a structured, safe process based on a lot of trust building and rapport to help people restore the full context and to begin to sort through the meaning of that event. And that only maybe is the first step. And today we've touched a little bit about forgiveness. Amends doesn't quite sound like the right word, but maybe like a corrective life experience somehow. People are trying to connect back to those good values that they were built on and want to carry forward. And sometimes it's very hard for people to find an expression of that in their life today. So in my mind, that's also an essential part of therapy. The VA really is, I'd say, in a process of shifting towards being more responsive to this priority. And it's only recently become a clearly identified priority, and there are some really important work going on in terms of research and treatment models that are being developed so that we can do a better job with this.
Let me get Tara. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Marty, if I could, just something that I've learned is that people who are in service, in the military service, when they get out, often find enormous value in engaging in service. So we're talking about community and nonprofits, volunteering. There's a lot of veterans organizations that are good vehicles for ex-servicemen, veterans to volunteer. And as I say, I think that can be a very healing experience to begin to give back and to get into that habit again of service.
Mm. Let me get back to the callers. We have Tara from Reading joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Tara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Excuse me. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard your guest talk about group therapies and individual therapies. I had an uncle, my favorite uncle, who went to Vietnam. And when he came back, he was a completely different person. He was the funny uncle, and when he came back, he was just ripped apart. And through his flashbacks, he had full audio visual flashbacks, we could see how much shame that he carried. And I'm wondering, what are some of the practical things that we as family members, as loved ones, can do, can offer our veterans when they come back, when they are experiencing these things? How can we, what are the little things that we can do to help them integrate back in?
And Tara, is your uncle, is he still alive?
No. Unfortunately, he used heroin as a way of coping, and he died of HIV-related illness as a result.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Peter signaled me he wants to talk to you, Tara. Go ahead, Peter.
Tara, thanks for your call, and I appreciate you raising such an important and practical question about what all the rest of us can do, family especially, but anyone really in the within the circles of our veterans. I think the first thing that can be done is to recognize that if you haven't seen the ocean, you don't know it, and to really then let that inform your stance of how you relate to our veterans, and to really prioritize just listening, just making yourself available. Knowing that the person is on their own time, schedule in terms of when they will begin to move in that direction. And we can't force that. We can only offer a listening ear, a priority of there being no judgment, of not being too pushy. And we can also, listen to programs like this. There's more and more literature where civilians can really commit to understanding these painful complexities about war. When you know these things, even secondhand, it deepens your capacity to be responsive. And when veterans feel that in you, they will begin to talk.
David, we only have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye here, but just touching on the fact that you both have talked about what a tiny number of people in this country fought in our more recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it does disconnect us. I think that there's this huge disconnect between the civilian population and those that went to war and their families. And I wonder whether that sort of created a denial for the civilian population about what people have been through.
You know, I think it's worse than just just a separation. I think both sides are yearning to know each other better. You know, every time I write from the battle zone, I get emails from people saying, thank you for writing about our soldiers and troops and Marines. What can I do? How can I get to know them? Who can I send a package to? I want to connect. So I think there's sort of a pent-up civilian acknowledgement that we don't know our military people very well, and we don't really know the kinds of situations we send them into. Again, this idea of service, I've really become interested in this as not just as a way for veterans to get back into service and to feel, again, that connection with doing something good, but also the rest of us. I mean, there are lots of nonprofits, community nonprofits, where you can go participate with veterans in a service project. I can hardly think of anything better than that. Mm.
What's been the response to your series, David?
It's been very sobering. I think the problem is worse even than I thought. I think many, many more people and family members are bearing the burdens of moral injury. And I think it's good that we're beginning to acknowledge and to talk about it.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you wrote it and wrote the series, and David Wood, that you joined us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And the three-part series in the Huffington Post about moral injury, David Wood, a senior military correspondent for HuffPost, and he won a Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for his series on the wounded veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Peter Yeomans, thank you very much as well.
Thanks very much.
You're
glad
welcome.
To be here.
Nice to have you both here. And he's a clinical psychologist at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times as well. You can carry on this conversation. Go to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. And while you're there, check us out on Facebook and Twitter. And you can also download the podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.